And that's one of the things about religion that we have to remember when we're talking about that makes it such a hot topic issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy, like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Hive Mind. Today is October 5th, 2020. I am your host, Nate Kapp. Welcome to the 20th Cubbyhole Podcast, where important topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. Our website is cubbyhole.com. That's CubbyHole.com. Today we have Douglas Martin back on the show. I'm really excited to see what he has to extrapolate on with the ideas from podcast number 19. So welcome back, Douglas.
Great to be back, Nate.
On our last show, Douglas gave us the meaning of westing. He extrapolated on the meaning behind westing and the Setian principle. He also covered the origins of secret societies, just the basic origins of secret societies, and the derivation and meaning behind what a cult is. Today we're going to go further and extrapolate on those topics, especially secret societies and cults. And we may even cover some important knowledge regarding mind control, since we've kind of got away from that a little bit, but maybe we'll incorporate that into this show. Something we'll be getting into on the next show for sure. One of the first questions that I have is, you say that the Stellar People are the pyramid builders. What I want to know, and I think what a lot of people would love to know, is how does one come to know and understand that?
That's a tough question. Main thing is we have to take into consideration that what the Stellar People are doing is all about the number seven. And ultimately, when we fully understand the meaning of the structure, we can flesh out that it's all about this number seven. This has no regard to the solar cult, because the solar cult is largely dealing with the 12 and the 13 being the path of the sun, which is the one, and then the 12 houses of the zodiac, which gives us the 13. And that's in relation to the 14, which would be the basis of essentially the lunar doctrine. So this is hard to explain, because as the mythology evolved through the different phases, we have to consider that they're trying to bring on the tenets of the earlier phases of the mythology into the later phases. So this is partly facilitated through this seven. So I think when we're studying the mythology, we need to kind of keep that in relation to this number seven, as we're trying to understand the significance of the other numerology. So the best way to make that, or to codify that as a foundation, is to say that all things seven are the little bear, and all things 12 are dealing with the zodiac.
Right.
And to balance that out, we have to understand that the lunar phase of the mythology falls between the stellar mythos and the emergence of the solar mythos. So part of understanding the lunar doctrine is kind of understanding how the stellar would be brought on into the lunar with regard to this seven. So that helps us understand the beginning of the lunar phase, and then the end of the lunar phase in relation to the emergence of the solar phase. So as we understand the stellar in its pinnacle of its evolution, and then the beginnings of the solar, that kind of gives us an idea of the beginning and the end of the lunar. And in each case, they're trying to bring on tenets of the old. And, you know, ultimately that becomes corrupted. But in its initial onset, I think it's benevolent. I think that it's a genuine effort to keep the connection with Source. So the seven has everything to do with that.
So hold on for real quick. So what you're saying, so see, because the way I would think most people would see it is like, how do you know that there were these people that were, you know, called the stellar people who were pyramid builders? How do you know that they actually lifted the blocks and, you know, made them into this pyramidal shape? You know, are you saying, you know, are you getting to that point, or are you making the point that it's more important to understand, you know, the numbers, the numerology in correspondence with each other, and, you know, that it's more of a, it's about more about understanding the spiritual essence of it?
No, I'm saying it's about understanding the culture and understanding what they're endeavoring to do. So there's, you know, from a mature perspective of this, the student taking themselves seriously in their research, there's no easy answer to that question. And it's a good question. Obviously, that's the question that is perplexing academia.
Right.
So if we're going to flesh it out, we have to exceed academia. Everything that we've discussed up to this point and are going to continue to discuss about this stellar phase is going to help explain that. I think part of what you're getting at is, how do we understand the timeline? How do we understand how much time it actually represents? Why are the estimates so skewed, especially in what we might call Egyptology and archaeology? You know, why are they having such a difficult time understanding it, or is it totally co-opted and a controlled narrative, which in many ways it seems to be? I mean, these are part of the forbidden areas of research, it seems. Particularly, I'm going to mention philology and etymology. It's as though academia has gone into the areas of Egyptology and archaeology and etymology and the origins of language and philology and put up no trespassing signs everywhere. So it's like we're trotting on forbidden ground, and that they've laid claim, or that, you know, they're trying to monopolize a claim, which I think we've already laid out enough information to show is inept. But we're going to continue to do that. That's what I mean when I say listen to the rhetoric when you're studying these other Egyptologists. You know, I mean, all the way back to Wallace Budge. We have to find the ineptitude in his work. And, you know, I said that what we're able to flesh out now has only been possible for the last 100 years. What I mean by that is that before J. Norman Lockyer and Gerald Massey's work, there's not really enough information, particularly about Babylon, or Egypt for that matter, to do the comparison between the two. So it's what we now know about Babylon that we've only known for the last 100 years that allows us to contrast and compare that to the Egyptian and flesh out these deeper secrets and start to get this timeline into focus. You know, as I said, the stellar people measured time in these epochs of the Great Year Cycle, and they did leave records of that. So we have at least 11 documented epochs. That constitutes roughly 250,000 years. And that will be disputed in the Egyptology community. But it will, you know, what their contention is won't necessarily make what we're saying untrue. So we have to be able to examine the artifacts with objectivity. And since we have to really bring a certain amount of knowledge to the information. I mean, ideally, the term Freemasonry is misleading. But the evolution of the human mental processes, which we can say is the evolution of the human race, or constitutes the latter part of the evolution of the human race, is pari passu with the evolution of Freemasonry. It's in lockstep. So we can't understand the origins and evolution of the human race without understanding the origins and evolution of what we know in the modern world as Freemasonry. If it makes us feel more comfortable, we can just refer to that as a mystery tradition. You know, we can get into the controversy, what came first, tarot or Kabbalah or Freemasonry. But, you know, I would tell you it's all forms of Freemasonry, because Freemasonry definitively defines the whole. The menorah, for instance, composes or essentially is the Kabbalah. And we've been talking about these large numbers for these timelines, and I'm trying to express that it goes that far back, that the pyramids had been built 150,000 years ago, and that basically typifies the end of the stellar mythos, the stellar phase, and that the Kabbalah has been with us longer than that. But Double Cube has been with us longer than Kabbalah, and they're both part of the same teaching. I mean, ideally, I would make the claim that it's all Freemasonry. It doesn't really feel right to me to say it's all Kabbalism, because that's not encompassing enough. It doesn't use the builder's tools. It didn't start with Double Cube. And, you know, the Double Cube is dealing with the four and then ultimately the eight, the four cardinal points and the four more semi-cardinal points, which give us the eight. That came before the menorah. That came before the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. But we know that the Kabbalistic Tree of Life incorporates the pillars, in a sense. And therefore, it's a model which constitutes a method that's very similar in many ways to the first degree tracing board of Freemasonry, which deals with the two pillars and then ultimately the third Ionic pillar, which corresponds to the path of mildness in the Kabbalistic tradition, and the pillar of Joachim corresponding to the path of severity, and the pillar of Boaz corresponding to the path of mercy. So I just wanted to show you some of the ubiquity in Freemasonry. And then, of course, the tarot incorporates symbolism with the pillars. So they all have this close relation. You know, the direct answer to your question is that there is no instant gratification. There's no easy answer.
Right.
And I don't think most people are this far along on their personal journey, and maybe never will get this far on their personal journey, where they get into the anthropology. I am telling you that it's vital that a lot of the things that we discuss that are more advanced will need to become common knowledge. As to how much into the anthropology everybody has to go, to hear me tell it, we're not getting out of this without understanding the stellar mythos.
And what is it that we're not getting out of?
We're not getting out of the perpetuated condition of what we were discussing as Westing. We're going straight into materialism. We're going straight into the solar force. You know, the more we associate with sensuals, the less we can associate with spirituals. And this is all related to Westing, which we've been discussing.
Yeah, and for those who haven't heard podcast number 19, definitely go back and listen to that, where Doug extrapolates on Westing. He does a very, very good job of helping us understand how we have strayed from the generative principle of care, of true care.
There's no real easy answer, and you're not going to have something that you didn't earn. And we're talking about things that very few people understand or have understood. We're going to have to, a certain degree, take our time with this stuff.
Right.
I'm not really going to sound, I mean, it might sound rhetorical, but if I'm hammering on the same point, is because I know how few people understand it. And what you've presented is a very legitimate question that people want the answer to. But the fact is, if we're digging in the dirt and we don't understand the culture, which is based on what they care about and what they're endeavoring to do, there's no way that we could hope to understand what we're finding as we dig into the layers of the strata.
Right. This is all about, you know, like, you can't understand the one without the two. So that means, like, you can't, if you haven't, as far as I see it, if you only study, you know, the physical, the material, which is, you know, considered the body, but you haven't studied the spiritual side of what these stellar people cared about, then you really can't understand the full picture. You only have half the picture, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, if I say something to somebody, the pyramid is the ritual in stone of the seven, and they have no idea what I'm talking about.
Right.
And to understand the fullness of what this seven represents, it's going to take many, many years of research. And I mean, we all, I'm sure, have encountered how prolific the septenary is in all of the traditions. Almost every tradition that we find deals with some form of the septenary. So what is the significance of this septenary? Well, it's ancient, and it's the ubiquity that we want to look for when we do the comparative eclectic study across cultures or cultural research. The whole point I'm trying to make is it is an eclectic study. It requires an eclectic study, and it's the ubiquity that we need to find that give us evidence of common tenets or common traditions. Anything that one tradition is using that we find something similar to in another tradition, that's the ubiquity.
Mm.
And that's what we largely need to put our focus on. Yeah, because as I said before, as each culture had exodused out of the Nile Valley, whatever phase the evolution of the mythos was in at that stage would exit the Nile Valley, and then wherever it would arrive would immediately be going into a stagnated phase. In other words, from whatever point it left, it did not continue to evolve, so the best that it could do was to preserve its own symbolisms and customs that ultimately did become vestigial, did not evolve, and try to keep that preserved with the hope that at some point we could recover it and restore it to its pure form.
Yeah, and the ubiquitous symbols that you speak of that are found in all these different cultures would be, you know, like the moon, the sun, and the stars, right? That's what we're finding in all these cultures that I notice. And you know, this is to me what ties them all together and helps us, you know, go further back in time to see how to understand the aspects of consciousness within these, you know, found in these symbols, right?
I mean, yeah, you know, this is the cosmology where the knowledge was attempted to be stored and preserved in cosmology. But the ubiquity that I'm referring to, yeah, they all used the stars and the moon and the sun to demonstrate a cycle, which is about a fertility cycle. So the idea of fertility is about incarnation, which is our creation story, and then reincarnation, which is our everlasting existence. So fertility is relevant to that, because contrary to that is infertility, and that constitutes a stagnation, ultimately a cessation or extinction. So this idea of this fertility in relation to agriculture and, you know, when to plant, when to harvest, when to sow, when to reap, that we don't reap if we don't sow, in correspondence with life as the preparatory phase for the afterlife, all these kinds of concepts associated with spiritual ideas. What I was trying to say is, yeah, the sun, the moon, and the stars are ubiquitous in that sense, because the only true divisions, when it comes right down to it, when we really understand what we're dealing with, the only true divisions are pre-totemic people, and then totemic, non-hero cult, or totemic hero cult. and the three hero cults that constitutes the real evolution, starting with Stellar, are Stellar, Lunar, and Solar.
Stars, Moon, and Sun.
Yeah, and I'm making the claim that the Stellar Fays, or the Stellar People of Egypt, are the pyramid builders, and they're primarily concerned about the seven. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that some of the more advanced ubiquity is dealing with this numerology. That we can definitely distinguish solar doctrine from stellar doctrine, because everything in the stellar is dealing with the seven, and everything in the solar is largely based on the 12. But we also have to consider that each phase of this mythology has its own chronology, and that the initial phase is not exactly the same as its pinnacle phase, or its advanced phase. So, for instance, the early stellar mythos begins in the southern hemisphere and venerates in the southern pole star. So Set is the original primary deity. And then as they migrate north in the Nile Valley, which flows north at the halfway point, when they're recognizing both southern and northern circumpolar constellations, Set is basically accompanied or beginning to be rivaled by the Horus of the double horizon. So they're venerating in both pole stars, which I have said that constitutes the first contingency. What I want to say is the very first secret society, because the idea is that we need a contingency as we move away from source in case we break off and get cut off from source. So the idea is that the very first secret society is Horus of the double horizon, what we can call Horus Behutet, as a contingency to remember that Sut was original primary deity, because they're already aware that it's ultimately going to end up primacy in the north, which it does when they venerate into Ursa Minor, which is a big part of the reason why the pyramids were built.
So Behutet, Horus Behutet is, you said, is the original Horus, right? Like, are you, you're saying that that's where Horus originated from, is Horus Behutet. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I would say, you know, it's the beginning of recognizing Horus as one of the heroes.
Okay.
But we have to understand, I mean, they're venerating in the southern circumpolar constellations. Of course, they understand the polarity and its correspondence to the North Pole, but it's partly in relation geographically to the way the southern hemisphere is functioning opposite of the northern hemisphere with relation to the movement and the path of the sun and the changing of the seasons. Main point is, Sut is original primary deity. So as it moves toward the north, ultimately becoming primacy in the north, that means when it's primacy in the north, that the god of the North Pole, which we can call Horus, has fully deposed the god of the South Pole, which is Sut. So S-U-T is south. So at the halfway point, when it's Horus Behutet, yeah, that's the introduction to Horus divinized. So this is the beginning of the divinizing of the North Pole. So we're trying to make a distinction between understanding that the southern polarity or the southern pole has a counterpart, but that counterpart was not divinized at all until Horus Behutet. And that Horus Behutet was a contingency, because you're moving away from primary deity. In other words, they know it's going to go primacy in the north, or has the potential to go primacy in the north, which typifies the masculine energy. So the idea is that the Horus Behutet is a contingency to be able to reconcile that Sut had been original primary deity, and those constitute the source ideas. So let me just try to clarify this. Just try to simplify it, because it's not going to be easy to simplify, and it's never going to be simple. We have to understand that these ideas are perplexing our best minds, and have perplexed the best minds, and we're trying to flesh them out and directly present them it's going to have a certain weightiness or heaviness to it. It's going to be like staring directly into the light at first. We have to get familiar. We have to get comfortable with these terms, which we don't really hear on a regular basis. And most people associate Horus and Sut with solar doctrine and sunrise and sunset. And we're talking about the same name of the deity in a different phase before it's venerated in a solar cycle. So it's going to be very confusing. I'm trying to stay aware of what is perplexing people. I mean, ultimately, I'm trying to encourage you to do a lot of the reading.
Let me ask you something. When does Sut or Set, you know, what's the time period that Sut or Set comes up out of the south and becomes primary deity as primacy in the north?
Okay, these are advanced questions, okay? So there's no way I can directly facilitate the answer to that question. Everything I'm trying to say is part of the answer. And I can throw some things on there that are going to immediately cause a lot of contention, and people are going to either not be able to come to terms with it or refute it instantly. And I'm trying to lay the groundwork for us to be able to understand this, because it is possible.
Right.
But it's, like I say, there's no instant gratification. But go ahead and finish your point or your question, and I'm going to try to take that on as we go through this.
You know, I understand that that's a very tough question, as mostly all questions that have to do with the time period are hard questions, because, you know, we weren't alive for that, and, you know, we really don't have much to go off of other than understanding these rites and understanding the rituals, understanding the symbols and the numerology. I get that. I guess what I'm trying to say is, how does one come to understand how Set or Sut comes primarily from the south into the north as primary deity?
Oh, you mean why does it come into the north?
How and why?
Well, the how is associated with the migration in the Nile Valley, which is 4,000 miles long and flowing north. And this is based on the idea or the contention that I make that human civilization begins in the Great Lakes region of Africa. And what I call Egypt refers to the entire Nile Valley, which is 4,000 miles long, flowing north. So it's partly out of necessity, as they migrate north in this Nile Valley, and the necessity is how to preserve the knowledge.
Okay.
So the creating of the mythology is also a means. It's not just a means to understanding our eternal life and our eternal life force, but it's a means to understanding that it's an expression, first of all. So, you know, the mythology is an expression. So it's a means of expressing knowledge. Hmm. And so the necessity is partly in finding ways of storing knowledge or passing knowledge forward and preserving knowledge in ways that it can't be destroyed. So the whole idea of venerating in cosmology with mythology is about an expression that's attempted to be preserved somewhere where it can always be reconciled and cannot be destroyed.
Right.
So like in The Lion King, when he's telling him to look into the stars to reconnect with his ancestry, which in that case was his own father who had been slain, it's really about that the knowledge was stored in a very special way in the cosmology, and that it's up to us to gather enough knowledge unto ourselves by any means available, essentially, in whatever predicament we find ourselves in, and still be able to reconcile it, because the stars are still there. They can't be destroyed.
Right.
So as we said earlier on one of the earlier shows, all new religions endeavor to obliterate all traces of their predecessors. I'm saying that, you know, our earliest ancestry understood that there was potential for the earliest human mental processes to become endangered as knowledge developed, which is the case, particularly in the solar phase. The solar phase have spent most of their energy endeavoring to obliterate all traces of their predecessors. So while in the beginning of the solar phase, yeah, they're trying to bring on the tenets of the stellar and the lunar, but as the solar phase moved forward and became more and more corrupted.
Westing, right?
It's westing in the sense that you've come into the north. It's right. Westing in the sense that you made it primacy in the north. But westing is associated with the solar doctrine. So if we're talking south to north, we got to clarify. You know, we go back to, if we turn the first degree tracing board onto its right side, as we move towards the west, we're moving towards the floor of base consciousness. And that the solar pillar goes on top, which is where we find the northern direction, and that corresponds to primacy in the north. So that first degree tracing board really typifies what you're saying, but we have to be able to read it properly.
Mm-hmm.
That there's danger in going into this masculine imbalance. You know, why is the northern hemisphere associated with the masculine? You know, partly because it's rugged, partly because it represents erect, upright, the upper.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of reasons that the masculine energy and the solar force is associated with the northern hemisphere. It represents, you know, like if you take a circle, this is in relation to solar doctrine, but it's still relative to stellar. Let's just say you take a two-dimensional view of the planet, and the northern pole is at the top and the southern pole is at the bottom, and then you divide that in half with the equator. Well, everything above the equator represents a half circle in an upright form, which corresponds to blade, which is equilateral triangle in an upright position. That's masculine. It's the mound. It's the mountain. It's the mount. It's masculine because it's, even though it's not pointy, it still represents, it typifies a hill. And that typifies a penetrative quality, like an upright triangle typifies a penetrative quality. So the triangle inverted, the lower southern portion of the hemisphere below the equator, represents the chalice. That's symbolic, typifying feminine principle, the chalice, which is typified by inverted equilateral triangle. So what I'm trying to say is these are the kinds of ideas that the stellar people who are the pyramid builders are concerned about. So we have to understand that they have this knowledge base, and that this knowledge base took hundreds of thousands of years to develop and understand. I like to say it this way. The stellar people could not afford the luxury of dogma. So their very survival depended on truth. So truth is that which they cared about above and all else, because they cannot afford the luxury of dogma. Their very survival depends on understanding truth, and everything that they did in that earlier civilization is about finding truth and finding ways to preserve truth. So we're talking about a body of knowledge that took a tremendous period of time to develop, and methods to teach it along with the knowledge developed over long periods of time. So the idea is, if that knowledge gets lost, there's not really any way to recover it, or potentially there's a potential for it to be lost forever. So a lot of what they're endeavoring to do is find ways to prevent that from happening, including the building of the pyramids.
Speaking of the builders of the pyramids and understanding the origins of the pyramids, or the stellar cult, you gave us a tiny peek into the idea of the origins and secret societies, which I find to be very fascinating on how anyone could come to understand something like that, especially if one comes from the historical evidence angle, which is, you know, that's what a lot of people are going to come to it from. I think many may want to know a specific year or when this started, and, you know, this is a pre-question that I asked, that I thought I was going to ask earlier, and I ended up already kind of asking you where or what time these things took place, and I know that it's very hard to really like pinpoint that, but I think many want to know a specific year when this started, and how did you come to know that, when I'm talking about secret societies.
If we're using in terms of a particular year, well, that year that we're talking about doesn't exist in any context of what we know as modern calendar.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to estimate based on how many years back, and we're going to do that based on great year cycles. So how many great year cycles, which constitute roughly 26,000 year cycle, have evolved, or how many great year cycles have commenced and recommenced, let's say, since the pyramids were built, or let's say how many great year cycles have commenced and recommenced since it became Horus of the Double Horizon, before it went Primacene and North. So I'm just going to try to give you an example here to show you how difficult that is, but what that work looks like and sounds like, okay? And when we study Indigenous America, we're going to find that it's difficult, because a lot of the information that we want is not available to us. And in working with what we got, in many cases, it seems like, ironically or strangely enough, we don't have as much even local, you know, because we're here in America, traces of these indigenous peoples. So that this European phase of this solar cult has done one hell of a tremendous job obliterating most of what was here in the Northern Americas regarding the indigenous cultures. So just as an example, this is going to give you an idea what the research is going to entail and help us better understand. Okay, so, you know, because I want to say, in a way, I'm giving you a hypothetical number, but it's not a hypothetical number when we understand how to flesh it out. And that the evidence that we need to flesh out this timeline is largely only in the Nile Valley, but we can use what we find spread out all over the globe and finding the ubiquity to corroborate and confirm what appears to be happening as we dig down into the strata and the layers only in the Nile Valley. So for instance, I'm making the claim that all of the indigenous American peoples that were here before the European colonialists had exodus at some point, at some phase, post-totemic or pre-totemic, from Egypt. If it's post-totemic, then they have customs. And these customs are largely in a stagnated form, but still they're endeavoring to preserve what they have. And so much time has passed, in many cases, they don't understand the full significance of it. But the very fact that they endeavored for so long to preserve what they had, it does survive into the modern world. And with the amount of knowledge that we have now, particularly concerning Babylon and Egypt, we can start to make sense out of what we're finding. So, for instance, obviously North America is fully in the north, and that represents primacy in the north. But strangely, many of the indigenous American cultures still have Sut as their primary deity. That's why we have tribes like the Crow. So let me just, I'm going to make this assertion here. In my estimate, the earliest indigenous American totemic peoples had arrived here, in my estimations, about 250,000 years ago. So if that's true, and then we're finding the cultures that still have Sut as primary deity, and the pyramids are built 150,000 years ago, and that's primacy in the north, which we know means Horus as god of North Pole primary deity, then we know that Horus Behutet, Horus of the Double Horizons, is happening somewhere between 250 to 150,000 years ago. So we can make a safe estimation that roughly Horus Behutet happened about 200,000 years ago. And that the, you know, because I'm saying that that the stellar cult is at least 300,000 years old. But, you know, in my research, I think it's probably closer to 500,000 or 600,000 years old, which means it had evolved into the hero cult phase beyond totemic sociology. But that we have to remember that these early myth makers were also the early astronomers, and that they're using the stars to store knowledge. That's what I'm trying to say. So the early myth makers constitute the earliest hero cult, and the earliest hero cult constitutes evolving beyond totemic sociology, and that the earliest myth makers, which constitutes an expression of the knowledge, are the also the earliest astronomers, and therefore, as they write into the urinography, become the earliest cosmographers. So we need to know all these terms. And remember the list of questions I gave at the end of the first show. We're going to deal with those questions. But if you have an indigenous culture in North America that's called the Crow, that's your sign. I mean, that they still have Set as primary deity. However, they're fully in the North. And that the indigenous peoples had arrived here from Africa, let's say roughly around 250,000 years ago, still Sut as primary deity, and that the pyramids were built 150,000 years ago, that gives us some idea that somewhere between 200 and 150,000 years ago, we had Horus Behutet, which is the first contingency, which I've already made the contention that that was the very first secret society, which meant it was actually a contingency that as it moved into the North, we wouldn't break our connection with Source. We're Set as primary deity. So, you know, we've opened up a lot of difficult subjects. I'm not giving you the kind of hard data that you're asking for, but see, there's no real easy solution to this. We got to understand this is perplexing our best minds.
Right.
So let's be humble and honest with ourselves that we're taking on some of the most difficult information that there is. And in my perspective, it's the most important information because, you know, I've heard people say or in their research have a lot of profound knowledge about, let's say, for instance, the fact that the pyramid complex does represent an analog of Solomon's temple. So, you know, this might sound strange to somebody, but I would say that the pyramids are the greatest Masonic temple that were ever built. And yes, it is originally Solomon's temple. So that's advanced. So a researcher that has deduced that through the study of the mystery traditions is into the advanced work, but may not be advanced enough into the work to deduce that that is the ritual of the Stone of the Seven, with the Southern Pyramid representing the Lunar Pyramid corresponding to Southern Hemisphere, the Northern Pyramid corresponding to the Solar Pyramid corresponding to the Northern Hemisphere, masculine solar energy, and that the Great Pyramid is the ritual and Stone of the Seven attributed to the Stellar Cult, and venerated into Ursa Minor, which will always be Semper Supra, always above, always most high. So we have to understand that in that perspective, that part of the reason they stored it in Ursa Minor was because it would always be above. And we can identify that it's always above and associate that with most high. Whereas from the perspective of living in the Southern Hemisphere, venerating into the pole, that would be Southern Pole. But ideally, when we factor in the North, North is always above the South. So the spiritual idea associated with Southern Hemisphere was basically flipped over. The main thing is it's inverted. And that the significance of the Southern Hemisphere is still more significant in association with Southern Hemisphere. The spiritual idea of the spirit above and putting it into Ursa Minor is confusing because it has the potential to dominate and obscure the fact that Southern Hemisphere is associated with this feminine, which is associated with spiritual. So these are kind of things that I'm saying that the stellar people cared about and they understood. because these are the forces that we actually are working with in this time space, three dimensional time space continuum, in the physical reality. Mm-hmm. That these are the forces that we're working with that are unseen, and that they fully understood these forces, and that the way that these forces were expressed and the way that these forces were endeavored to be codified for progeny and posterity, there's danger,
right,
if they're not understood. So putting it primacy in the north is dangerous because the southern hemisphere is always associated with the spiritual realm. And that gets confusing because we know triangle represents the spiritual triune. It's a spiritual principle. And that the square represents the physical realm,
the material,
with the four points, the material, and that the triangle always goes on top of the square. That's confusing because we're starting out with southern hemisphere associated with spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm.
So I know this is really stretching our brains out here hearing this, but this is really what it's about.
Yeah.
So if you're not fully understanding it, maybe I'm not doing the best job explaining it, but that's not the point. We have to understand it.
Yeah,
I'm only trying to encourage you to understand it, because if we don't understand it, we don't understand why the pyramids were built in the first place.
Yeah, you actually just blew my mind with that, because I never, until on this show right now, I never realized that moving into the north, westing into the north, is when, you know, when we understand the aggregate of consciousness, and then we understand how each one of us are fragments of that consciousness. When most of our minds have been moved into this imbalance of masculine energy, or being in an imbalance of the left brain. And so when I think of the spirit, I think of ego as the lower part, right? And so I think of ego associated with left brain dominance.
I corroborate that.
And because of that, I'm seeing now that by Set moving into the north, it represents the material moving on top of the spirit, which it should be the opposite. It should be that the spirit is above the material. And I'm seeing that now. I'm understanding where you're coming from with that. I think you did a really good job of explaining that, because now I'm understanding more and more of why this was so important to the stellar people, because once the material goes on top of the spirit, that's when we live in the westing world.
Masculine force is the dominating factor.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
And this is where we get
everything is flipped right now.
Yeah, this is where we
flipped.
Get the term upset, and that basically manifests as the unseen shadow work not being dealt with, not embracing and understanding the whole self, including the negative shadow of the self. That degree. You see, it's confusing, but this is where we get the idea of upset, and it literally manifests as what we refer to often as zombie land.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's literally what we have, is the walking dead, in the sense that they're spiritually deadened people.
Mm.
So we are in zombie land because everybody's upset. They don't understand how the masculine force has dominated the feminine, and that this is an internal conundrum that can only be rectified on the individual level in the psychology of understanding the forces with which we're working, and what is their proper orientation.
Man.
It's difficult material. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm prepared to be patient, but if we look at where the world is today, I wouldn't say that we have all of the time in the world to get this done. And I would say that, as I've already stated, it's only been possible in the last 100 years, so we can't squander this opportunity. That, you know, our ancestors, through the period of nescience, all of their efforts will be in vain if we don't capitalize on this opportunity where for the first time we actually have the ability to flesh it out for the most part and fully understand why these pyramids were built, understand what they mean, understand what these forces are that we're actually working with. See, people have a lot of misconceptions about spiritual ideas. That's part of how science is allowed to marginalize it all as superstition and just leave it at the door. You know, this is the conundrum in science. It's what we know as empiricism. In order for there to be something objective, it has to be an object. So we know that's a fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideas that we're talking about correspond to what we call this ancient psychology and this triune brain paradigm in correspondence with left brain, right brain, which correspond to these unseen forces, which right. we can associate with masculine and feminine forces that correspond to materialist and spiritual ideas. So yeah, there's a lot to it, but see, I don't want to discourage you with that. I want to encourage you that as we keep going forward with this, we're going to get more and more of the prerequisite knowledge coming out onto the table to understand, and it's going to come more into focus. And one more thing I want to say is that, you know, in regard to the idea, let's just say the idea of a truth movement, not saying that there is such a thing, but, you know, it's a lot of people have good intentions. What, you know, as far as what the significance of the progress that they've made, that's another story. But what I'm trying to say is, based on what I see, I think people are ready to see how the knowledge applies. And that's where the, you know, that's the interesting stuff, because things are unraveling. But if you don't have the prerequisite knowledge to understand the significances of it, you're not really going to understand how it's unraveling. So I can show you how to apply the knowledge and it'll unravel. What I'm trying to say is most of what's in the modern world is post-Osiris, because they've obliterated everything that came before. So if we learn the ritual of Osiris and understand its full significance, which is the pinnacle of solar doctrine, most of the dogma in the world will unravel. But there's still a great deal of knowledge that will not unravel just by applying the solar doctrine alone. We need the earlier ideas from the lunar, ultimately the stellar, to fully unravel the significances of the septenary, for instance. And we know how prolific the septenary is. So we're really endeavoring to give you the foundations of the ideas, because hopefully at some point we'll, in this series, we're going to get to the point where we've laid enough groundwork and then start to show you how it unravels everything that came after. For instance, we've already mentioned, but I'll mention it again. Rome is built on the city of seven hills and faced by the Vatican, which gives us, typifies the eight, which we put in, the emphasis on is the care, is the one, is the representation of the generative principle. So Rome is a solar cult that built on the stellar hallowed ground that was existed before the solar cult. And that ought to be enough proof that the pyramids are the ritual in stone of the seven. Okay, and maybe a lot of people don't know about this, but you know, Cincinnati is the romantic term for the city of seven hills. So we have to understand at the onset of the solar cult, what they did was they gridded out the hallowed ground of the stellar people and built their temples on top of the destroyed stellar temples. You know, there they destroyed the stellar temples and built their solar temples on top of it. So need to understand that all new religions endeavor to obliterate all traces of their predecessors, that they're building their solar temples on already hallowed ground of the earlier phases of the mythos in the earlier culture. So we can expect that this is happening in more places than just Rome. In other words, there was other cities of seven hills. For instance, I'm in Columbus, Ohio. Well, just about an hour and a half south of me is the city of Cincinnati, and it's famous for its mounds. And I don't have to go there to know that there's seven, because it means the city of seven hills. And the significance of those seven mounds typify or bolster my claim that the earliest indigenous Americans are stellar people in a stagnated form. And I'll just give you one more example that's a little bit less significant of this unraveling, but, you know, just for example, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. That's the seven glorious ones, or the eight glorious ones, or Horus and the seven glorious ones, and the Care. And the dwarves are Ursa Minor.
Right.
They're elemental powers. So Horus represent the enlightened being, the stellar man, head in the cosmos, feet on the ground, typified by the seven, as close as we can be to God in the physical manifestation, is typified in that fable. So that fable is ancient. Maybe the fable didn't come into existence until more contemporary times, but the idea for the fable is ancient, and there's no way that whoever basically constructed the fable didn't draw from the remnant of the earlier idea, which is a stellar concept based on the seven in relation to eight and the seven in relation to the six.
Right.
So it's Snow White and the seven dwarves, and the seven typifies Horus and the six glorious ones. You know, here's how you find the eight. I mean, it's one constellations plus the seven stars that make up the constellation, or it's one universe and the seven stars of Ursa Minor. You know, so the eight is present, or the one is present to extend and get to the eight, or the return to the eight. There's so many points I want to make. Let me just throw this out there, because we've been talking about totemic sociology. We're going to get back into it. But the totem pole in a pure form is a seven or an eight, but in the purest form, it's a seven, which means that the top totem of the totem pole is bird-headed, which is Egyptian. But the point I'm making is, as we go into the hero cults, this is what makes it difficult, because see, the earliest phase of the mythology from the totemic sociology, is working with animism. And that's a confusing term that creates controversy. But so we'll talk about animism a little bit more, but it's the idea of spiritualizing everything. So we have to put that in context of spiritualizing everything that has true value, everything that's real knowledge, everything that has the potential to pass forward knowledge to progeny and posterity. That's the idea of animism. So in this totemic sociology, this is before they venerate into cycles. So the best way I would describe it is a stack. It's a stack which each totem of the stack represents a degree of merit. And then the top is bird-headed because that represents fully raised kundalini energy. That's different than venerating it into the cycle. So when it's venerated into the cycle in the northern circumpolar constellations through the succession of the northern circumpolar pole stars, commencing with the one, and then once it's succeeded by the seventh successive star, it's going to recommence. That seventh star corresponds to that top totem. So in the cycle, it's different than the stack. We have to remember that. And I know that's advanced. We'll explain that more as we go, but just in one more thing I want to say. We can bring on that totemic sociology into the hero cult mythological phase, where it becomes what we know in modern masonry as Jacob's ladder. So the totem pole is Jacob's ladder because it represents a degree in merit.
Right.
And while I'm thinking of it, one of the mistakes that most people make, I've seen, is they reach for the higher rungs of the ladder before they've done their fundamental work. And you can't do that. You can't grab or grasp the higher rungs of the ladder until we get the foundations. And the foundations are where the real arduous work is. And
yeah,
the more we understand that, the more we understand why people aren't doing it and haven't done it and in all likelihood aren't going to do it until they've suffered enough.
Right.
They're only going to do it when they realize there's no getting out of it.
Right. Well, again, it's been a pleasure to have you back on. And, you know, I'm really excited that we have this opportunity to get together and extrapolate on these really hard, heavy ideas. And, you know, it's really cool that I got to be on a show where my mind was blown. That was the first time that's happened since I've been on here, where I learned something that I really didn't know. And it's pretty exciting. So, and that's something that I love about doing this, is that, you know, I'm not just here to help others understand these ideas and to, you know, teach these difficult topics, but I'm here to learn, and I'm here to keep pushing myself and transcending dogma.
It's great to be part of the project, and I'm grateful for all that you do. And I'll look forward to speaking with you again on a future show.
This show is at an end, guys. So we appreciate you giving your time and attention here on this Cubbyhole podcast. And if you go to our website, which is cubbyhole.com, that's CUBBYWHOLE.com, you'll find more of Douglas Martin's work along with all the rest of the podcast episodes. And you'll find much more videos and news. So we hope you found value here on this show. And please make sure to go back to podcast 8 and 19 to better understand this show and future shows with Douglas pertaining to the ancient Egyptian mythos particularly. So stay tuned for more. Thanks, and keep transcending dogma.